Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. Recent surveys show that 1 in 6 American teens has considered suicide, and 1 in 12 actually attempts it. Everyone knows that childhood, especially adolescence, can be a challenge. Anxiety is a normal part of growing up. That makes it all the more difficult to know when a child's ups and downs have turned into a roller coaster off its rails and whether they need help. Joining us now to talk about that is Bernadette Melnick, OSU's Chief Wellness Officer, Dean of the School of Nursing, and a professor of pediatrics and psychiatry at OSU's College of Medicine. Welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ann. Happy to be here.
I just mentioned the statistics regarding thoughts of suicide and attempted suicide among teens. How prevalent are clinical anxiety and depression in children?
Well, depression is more common in the adolescent age group. And we have to remember that depression and anxiety often are comorbid.
And that means they're at the same time.
They happen at the same time. There's a lot of anxiety. The three most prevalent mental health conditions in children and teenagers are anxiety, depression, and attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. The thing is, Anne, that a lot of behavioral problems get quicker attention, especially in schools, because kids are acting out. It's the internalizing disorders, which include anxiety and depression, that can often go along for a long period of time before children really do get help and treatment.
If we know about the comorbidity factor, and that often, say, if you're diagnosed with ADHD or ADD, which again would be that behavior trigger, that you probably or often a child is often suffering from either depression and or anxiety, right?
Absolutely. A lot of children with attention deficit disorder also have comorbid anxiety and or depression. However, it's important to remember that there are some children who are diagnosed with ADHD that are misdiagnosed. And instead, they do have underlying anxiety disorder. Okay. So you have to tease all of these symptoms
and it's
apart.
Manifesting itself in ways that get it misdiagnosed as ADHD.
Exactly. Because kids who are anxious, they can look like a child with ADHD because they can be restless, have trouble paying attention because they're worriers. So they're worrying about what's going to happen. They often, again, get very restless and can't concentrate. So you really need evaluation by a good, sharp provider who can accurately diagnose, put all these symptoms together and diagnose kids correctly so they can have the appropriate treatment that's going to work.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest this hour, Bernadette Melnick. She's a frequent guest, and today she's wearing her professor of pediatrics and psychiatry hat at Ohio State's College of Medicine, where she teaches. She's also OSU's chief wellness officer and dean of the School of Nursing. If you have a question or comment about mental health issues for adolescents and teens, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So you recommend evaluation by a good, sharp provider. But we've talked before about the shortage of any providers for mental health evaluations and treatment for adolescents and young people.
Exactly. I would start with the primary care provider, either the nurse practitioner or the pediatrician, who should be versed enough to have a good assessment. And if they feel it's out of their diagnostic realm, they can go ahead and refer. But the important thing is for a parent to talk to the child's primary care provider about potential worries or issues they have about the child. Now, I want to differentiate normal anxiety,
right,
fear and anxiety, from when it's really getting into a mental health disorder.
Okay.
And one of the things that I always tell parents is, remember, it is normal for all children, no matter if they're a toddler, a preschooler, or a school-age child, or an adolescent, to have common developmental fears and anxieties. What sets abnormal apart from the normal fears and anxieties is when it interferes with the child's functioning. So if the child is persistently worried to the point where it is interfering with their schoolwork, their social relationships, their ability to engage in sports, those sorts of things, that begins to cross the boundary.
How do you know, though? Because every kid has different relationships, different sport. Not everyone's into sports. And school, maybe they're – how do you – what, say, with sports would be a behavior or something that we should raise a red flag?
Well, I always talk about change.
Okay.
You know, look for patterns of change in the child. If a child has been functioning well, engaged in extracurricular activities, suddenly when they're getting up in the morning, they're having belly aches, they're having headaches, they're saying, I don't think I want to go to school today, or maybe not saying that, but my belly. Stomach aches and headaches are such a glaring red flag for underlying anxiety issues, particularly in school-age children, as well as in adolescents. Very, very common.
And they may not really know that that's why they have a stomach ache.
You bet.
So they're not necessarily being manipulative or...
Now, some children
are.
Some children have learned that they can get secondary gains from this. And I have been successful at not going to school because the parents, of course, are worried about their child. We don't want to send our child to school with headaches or stomach aches and that sort of thing. But again, I think one of the important ways we deal with this in kids is you don't want to continue to facilitate that behavior. You want to get to the core root of the problem. And if it is an anxiety issue, we want to get the child appropriate evidence-based treatment that we know will work.
For a younger child, say under the age of 10, how do you figure these things out? How do you get them to express themselves in a productive way?
That's an excellent question. So in kids, even 7, 8, 9-year-old kids, if you ask them, do you worry? See, a lot of kids, younger kids, don't understand what stress is, although they certainly see their parents who are highly stressed many times today. But the kids do know what worry is. So I like to ask the kids about worry. With little preschoolers and toddlers, the way I get to what they're thinking and feeling is I often ask them to tell me about what their stuffed animal feels like, what their baby doll feels like, because that's an effective strategy with young kids. They often can't describe their thinking and feeling, but they will translate what they're thinking or feeling to their dolls or their stuffed animals. So first of all, I would say we need to be asking. Ask the kids. You know, if we ask them in ways that are developmentally appropriate, a lot of kids will talk to you and tell you, yes, I do worry. You know, they have difficulty sleeping at night. They're having a lot of nightmares. They're anxious. They're restless. They don't want to separate young children from their parents in normal situations. Those things need to be investigated further.
Anxiety and depression, they're closely linked, as you meant. They're often comorbid. Can we break down anxiety a little bit and talk about the difference between fear and anxiety? Again, fear is a natural, healthy thing.
You bet.
To a certain extent.
You bet it is. And again, I would say it is normal for kids at different stages to be fearful of different things. Like preschoolers, for instance, they have what's called magical thinking. So it's very real to them to believe there's a ghost in their room, there's somebody hiding under their bed. But then you take them to the bedroom, you pick up the bed skirt, you say, look, there isn't anybody there. It's normal for you to be afraid of these kind of things. That's normal. But again, it's this separation between are they functional with the fear or the worry or the anxiety, or is it interfering with what kids should normally be able to do?
Are kids, some of them, also good at cloaking all of this? So when you see the kids in a classroom and you can pick out the happy ones and the ones that are happy and chatty and have friends and blah, 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 does that automatically mean that everything's okay?
Well, I think, again, we don't want to read too much into certain things as well. But I would say, again, these kids, and we put a term on this called internalizing problems. They hold things in inside. So these kids don't tend to be the ones that are really super acting out. Now, I'm not saying that a kid with anxiety can't also manifest anger and behavior problems. Adolescents in particular, if there's a lot of anger in an adolescent, I'm often looking for underlying depression or anxiety, because that's a lot of times how those problems will manifest in adolescents or adults. In the young kid, again, you can have a very anxious child who can be restless in a classroom, inattentive, which makes a teacher or somebody else think that they have ADHD, but they have underlying anxiety. So again, you have to be very astute at assessing these particular issues and making sure the child or the teen doesn't have an underlying physical problem as well. So a good physical assessment and history is really critical before you're moving into the mental health diagnoses.
We have an email from Angel who asks, can teenagers have depression symptoms for months or years as adults can?
Absolutely. Now, there is major depressive disorder that lasts for just about 2 weeks. But there's another condition. We label it as dysthymia. It's a milder form, you can look at it that way, of major depressive disorder, where the child might be having less symptoms, but for a longer period of time, like a year, often is the criteria for diagnosis of that.
Well, we don't have more time to talk about this, but I'm sure we'll talk about it again. Bernadette Melnick, OSU's Chief Wellness Officer, Dean of the School of Nursing, and a Professor of Pediatrics and Psychiatry at OSU's College of Medicine. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
We'll continue with Wellness Wednesday in a conversation about nutrition when we return. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. We were just talking about depression and anxiety in children. For some resources, more information on that, we'll have some links on our website later today if you want to check that out, wosu.org/allsides. You can go there for some more resources and more information. We know that when it's cold, our bodies burn more calories. Yay, that's the good news. Maybe the only good news for folks like us who live in colder climates. Joining us now to talk about how to make the best of those cold days when it comes to nutrition is Monica Reinigal. She is a licensed nutritionist, chef, and creator of the popular Weekly Nutrition Diva podcast. She joins us by phone from Baltimore. Welcome to the show.
Good morning, Anne.
So, what about the cold weather? What is it? What's happening? And can I eat more in the morning, at least?
Well, it is true that we do have to burn up more calories to maintain our body temperature when the temperatures dip. But so, really, after the week we've just had, everybody should be 3 pounds lighter, right?
But
I would wager to guess that a lot of people are heading back to work and school this morning, not lighter, maybe even a little heavier.
Uh-huh.
And the thing is that although we do burn more calories, there was some research done in the Netherlands a while back that tried to quantify this. And when they put people in a room that was about 10 degrees cooler than usual, they actually burned an extra 150 calories that day. It's not a lot, but, you know, you'd think it would add up. The problem is they also ate more, and they actually ate about 250 more calories. So at the end of the day, they were behind 100 calories. So, you know, we tend to eat a little bit more when it's cold, and that may be our body's attempt to replace those missing calories. But it looks like, left to our own devices, we might overcorrect a little bit.
Would there be any benefit in turning down the thermometer or, you know, the thermostat in your house a little bit?
Well, potentially, yes. I can think of a couple of benefits. Not only might you burn a few extra calories, but you'd save on your heating bill that
month. Yeah, there you go.
But you'd want to be really careful that you weren't overcompensating then by eating a little bit more, because you may feel the urge to eat when you're chilly. And also, I don't know about you, but when the temperatures get this cold, I also just seem to be a little bit less active. Mm-hmm. I'm not outside. You know, I don't take my morning walk maybe because it's just too cold out there. And so our activity level dips. We're eating a little bit more. It's just not enough to, in other words, the few extra calories that we're burning by keeping the temperatures a little bit cooler get overwhelmed by those other factors.
So my effort to give people hope has fallen
That's
flat.
That's what I'm here for, to deflate all hope.
Right.
No.
That's Monica Reinigal. She is the Nutrition Diva, licensed nutritionist, chef, and creator of the popular Weekly Nutrition Diva podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. If you have a question for Monica, you can give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides at WOSU.org, or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. Monica, one of your recent posts was about how was about the USDA. They recently said they're permanently allowing schools to serve larger portions of meat and grains in school lunches. What prompted that?
Well, this is actually the last chapter in a drama that started about a year ago. We had never had any kind of limits on portion sizes or calorie counts in our school lunch programs, but about a year ago, national initiative to combat childhood obesity, the USDA took a look at the school lunches and said, well, maybe we can do something here, and they set some limits on the amount of calories that would be in school lunches. And specifically by limiting foods like French fries and pizza and hamburgers and, you know, the less nutritious foods and more calorie-dense foods. But at the same time, they said, but we won't put any limit on the fruits and vegetables, and in fact, we're going to require more fruits and vegetables in those meals. But this was a huge flop. There was a huge uproar from parents, from students who claimed that their kids weren't getting enough to eat anymore.
Because they weren't eating what they had.
That's exactly right. They weren't taking advantage of all of the additional fruits and vegetables. They were missing their French fries and their pizza, mm-hmm. and not serving themselves or even taking foods and then throwing it away. The people that were in the lunchrooms noticed that a lot of food was going into the trash. So maybe it wasn't so surprising that the kids were hungry, but they mounted a very successful PR campaign, the kids, about how they were hungry and it wasn't fair. And Congress stepped in and said, yeah, let's lift those limits. And then just recently, they made that temporary lift permanent. So they've basically just rolled back that initiative to the previous unrestricted.
So they can have pizza again.
Not only can they have pizza, but they can have as much as they want.
Huh. Okay, so you're concerned about that as a nutritionist, that the restrictions weren't really inappropriate. It was just that they weren't, the kids weren't eating what was given to them.
It was tricky, Anne, because it's very hard to put a kind of blanket number on how many calories each kid should be eating. They kind of broke them down into three groups, the primary school, middle school, and high school. And as the kids got older, they, you know, the guidelines added a few calories. But think of middle schoolers and the difference between the smallest and the biggest kid in fifth grade. Or a lot of the uproar was about student athletes who are obviously burning a lot more calories than their peers who maybe are on the math team, mm-hmm. and that they needed more calories and it wasn't fair to restrict them. So that was maybe it was doomed to failure from the beginning, because we really can't put one number and have it apply to four grades worth of kids. Maybe, but there's no denying that we have a growing childhood obesity problem. They're not eating well. They're taking in too many calories and too few nutrients. But maybe that effort would have been better spent on better nutrition education for the kids, helping, you know, motivate them and empower them to make more appropriate choices for themselves.
And also physical education?
Physical education, sure. I mean, the kids who are on sports teams are always going to have a higher calorie requirements than the kids who don't compete athletically. But certainly we want to be getting our kids into the habit of working physical activity into their daily routines, because that's a habit that we can really use as adults as well. And that's when we form habits, right, when we're in school.
You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. It's Wellness Wednesday. I'm talking with nutritionist Monica Reinigal. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513. Another thing we don't see much this time of year besides warmth is the sunshine, which is a source of vitamin D. There's been a lot of controversy about how much we need and how much we should get and how to get it. What do you recommend?
Well, you're right. Vitamin D has been very much in the public eye and very much a subject of research lately, and we're focusing on this nutrient like we hadn't before. And at this time of year especially, we do see that people's vitamin D reserves tend to dip the lowest because we're not getting as much sunshine. So this is the time that you want to make sure that you're getting as much vitamin D from your food as you can. And those foods would include oily fish, and also dairy products are usually fortified with vitamin D. But one of my favorite tricks, and this is sort of little known a source of vitamin D, are mushrooms. Mushrooms, even just the white button mushrooms that we buy in our grocery stores, can be a good source of vitamin D. But there's a little trick involved. You want to put your mushrooms out in the sun for 20, 30 minutes, because just like human skin, mushrooms actually produce vitamin D when they're exposed to ultraviolet rays. So if it's too cold for you out there, put your mushrooms out in a sunny window for a few minutes, and then that vitamin D will not be degraded by cooking, and that can be another way to get some extra vitamin D at this time of year when our levels tend to dip.
That's so interesting.
Isn't it?
Yes, it really is. What about supplements?
You know, I am in general not a big fan of vitamin supplements. I think that as a nation, we spend a lot of money and don't get a whole lot of benefit from all these pills, and that it can create a false sense of security that, well, you know, I don't need to worry too much about what I'm eating because I took my vitamin today. I covered my bases, but there's just no vitamin supplementation that can take the place of a healthy diet. That said, there are just a couple of nutrients that I think supplementation makes sense, and vitamin D is one of them, especially because it's so hard to get enough during the winter. So I do think that a vitamin D supplement is a good idea. I take one during the winter, and then in the summertime when I'm out in the garden and playing tennis, I lay off.
If you're not getting enough vitamin D, what do you feel like? What happens?
Yeah, this is the problem. It's a sort of an invisible deficiency. You probably won't feel any symptoms. Some people report that they feel, that when they start taking vitamin D, they feel more energy. Maybe they feel an effect on their mood. And there is some link between depressed vitamin D levels and mood problems. A little hard to tease out what's what there. It could also be that the lack of sunshine is affecting people's mood. So, but for the most part, there really are no symptoms when you're low in vitamin D. Your doctor can check, you know, he can do, when you go for your checkup, and this is getting increasingly common that doctors are running those vitamin D levels when they do the rest of your blood work to catch it because there are no obvious symptoms.
But if you go for a lengthy period of time with a deficit, is
right,
it your bones or your...
Yeah, what happens? Exactly. That can have a long-term consequence in terms of your bone health and strength because vitamin D is really important in allowing your body to use calcium and magnesium to strengthen your bones. And there's also some correlations with different kinds of autoimmune disorders, such as multiple sclerosis. I'm certainly not saying that everyone who is low in D is going to develop, you know, a serious disease. But there do seem to be some correlations between vitamin D deficiency and a lot of different diseases. So it makes sense for us to keep track of this, for this to be something that doctors screen for, and also just to try to take steps to make sure that we're getting enough.
We talk a lot about technology on this show, and you recently wrote about 4 apps meant to help people achieve their weight loss goals. Tell us what these 4 apps are.
Well, you know, this is just the latest generation of diet tracking apps. When everybody started using smartphones, a lot of apps sprang up that helped you count your calories and keep track of what you're eating, and people found them very helpful. You know, there's something about logging what you eat that really does make you mindful. It can help change behavior. It can be very motivating. And the smartphone just makes it that much easier to kind of tap it in while you're eating or while you're waiting for your meal to arrive, maybe. But now we have a whole new generation of apps. There's an app called MealSnap where you don't even have to enter in your foods. You can just take a picture.
I don't
of your
get
plate.
How that works.
I know, it's magical.
Well, how does it work? I mean, how does it know it's spaghetti and not...
Right.
Beets.
Well, this is a very closely guarded trade secret. This app was put out by the popular website Daily Burn. They released it, and they're not saying how they do it. And it kind of brings to mind, you know, a bunch of people in a room waiting for those pictures. You know, they've got a bunch of nutritionists in a room waiting for those pictures to come in, and they quickly analyze it. I don't think that's how they do it.
like the Keebler elves or something, right?
Exactly. But remarkably enough, it's pretty darn accurate and certainly makes it a lot easier. There's a very cool, this is more of a device than an app. There's something called the Happy Fork, which actually has a sensor, an accelerometer that senses how fast you're moving, and it keeps track of when you're eating too fast. And if you start to, gobble your food and take a lot of bites, it will start vibrating and blinking to cue you to slow down. How about that?
Yeah, I thought that was something I could really use, but I think you pointed out, or whoever I read pointed out that, unfortunately, so much of what is a lot of junk food is not stuff you eat with a fork.
That's
interesting.
Yeah, but you know, it is true that when people can train themselves to slow down, chew each bite thoroughly, it does have a big impact on how full you feel after you've finished eating, and also a little bit on how much nutrition you get from your food. So it's a great habit to develop. This seems like a sort of expensive way to reinforce that habit.
Why? But, how much does it cost?
It's about $100. And you charge it up just like you charge your cell phone. So it seems to me like a little bit of a stretch, but just funny to see how these different device and app makers are appealing to people who really want to make positive changes. There's another thing I thought was pretty cool called the Prep Pad, and it's a digital scale that you keep in your kitchen, and as you're cooking, you just put your foods on it, and it weighs them and calculates the nutritional information. So I guess it's another way of keeping track, but for those who cook at home, it would be a way to calculate the calories in a home-cooked recipe or meal that you might not be able to look up on your diet tracker. And that's kind of an interesting, and it'll beam that information right to your smartphone so that you can kind of see how that meal is taking shape or, you know, how it's adding up over the course of the day to make sure those calories are in line.
Because there's one thing research has shown us is when we keep track, we tend to lose weight.
That's exactly right. There is something about having to record that cookie that makes you just a little bit less likely to eat it. I think it's one part mindfulness mm-hmm. and one part accountability. And that's another thing that these smartphone apps have is the ability to share what you're doing on your social networks or on special social networks that are set up within that community. And there's something about telling other people what we're eating that helps, or whether we're working out, that helps keep us on track too. So there's some social support built in to these apps as well.
As a nutritionist, do you think you're part psychologist too?
I think that that's a very good question, Anne. And when I do nutrition counseling, I often feel that information about nutrition is not what my clients are most in need of. They kind of know what they should be eating, which ones of their habits are getting them in trouble. And very often when people consult a nutritionist, what they're really hoping for is someone that can help them change their behavior, because behavior change is hard. And yes, that is where I often wish I had more skills as a behavior psychologist that would almost come in more handy than knowing how many calories is in a half an avocado, you know?
Right. Well, Monica Reinagle,
mm-hmm.
thank you for joining us today.
It's been my pleasure.
Monica Reinagle, she is a licensed nutritionist, chef, and creator of the popular weekly Nutrition Diva podcast. We'll have a link to that on our website at WOSU.org/allsides. Coming up, our ongoing series about the ongoing rollout of the Affordable Care Act. So stay with us if you have questions. 614-292-8513. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. More than 1.1 million people have signed up for health insurance using the Federal Exchange. The healthcare.gov website experienced a surge of enrollment during December, 7 times the number 2 months prior, but it's left a lot of people asking, I think I'm covered. It's after January 1st. Now what? Joining us now to talk about that and more news on the Affordable Care Act is Charles Ornstein, senior reporter for ProPublica. Welcome back to the show, Charlie.
Thanks, Anne. Great to be here.
How do people know if they are, in fact, covered? The insurance companies are not all being prompt in sending insurance cards, or maybe it's not about promptness. It just takes time.
Right. So for folks in Ohio who've been to healthcare.gov, who've gone through the process of completing an application, before December 23rd or December 24th, the next step is to ensure that you have had contact with your insurance company, that you've made payments for that coverage, and that they have a record of your coverage. So there's been a lot of things going on behind the scenes. One of them is that there's been some issues in terms of transmitting information between the federal government and insurance companies. So that's one of the first places that things could have broken down. If somebody's application was not sent to the insurance company, the insurance company may not have any record that that person is enrolled. So you want to make sure that they have a record of you. Second thing is you want to make sure that you pay your bill. Some insurance companies have been slow to send out bills. And in fact, the deadline that most insurance companies have extended to pay until January 10th for coverage that began on January 1st. But say you didn't yet sign up for coverage. It's not too late to do it. It's too late to do it for coverage that began on January 1st, but you can still sign up today on healthcare.gov. You can do that through March 31st for coverage that would be in effect this year.
Now, in and of itself, that's not that unusual. My mom just signed up for new supplemental Medicare insurance,
yep.
And they said, you know what, make your first two payments no matter what, because it may not be set up by, it may take a month and a half to set this up. And this has nothing to do with, the Obamacare.
Anybody who has private insurance knows what it's like to deal with insurance companies,
right?
To change them, to get the information right on your card when you go to the pharmacy and present it and they don't get it right. So there's always, I mean, the whole insurance system is and there's inherent problems in it. I think the issue here is that things were so problematic in the initial rollout and came together at the very end in the last week of December before the deadline that insurance companies were sort of inundated, and they're still sort of plowing their way out of that. And so, for people who need coverage this month, if they have a chronic condition, if they need to go, if they have an emergency and they need coverage, there may be glitches initially with that. And I think those will sort themselves out over time.
Go ahead.
The real issue that will not necessarily sort itself over time is if somebody, say, chose a plan and they're properly enrolled, you're going to have folks who are surprised at the deductibles they have to pay before their coverage begins in earnest. Some people may have to pay a couple thousand dollars or even more before they actually have coverage for the things that they need. So that could be a surprise to people. What else could be a surprise to people is if their doctors or hospitals that they've been getting covered, been treated by up to now, are not taking part in their plan. So those are things that in time will not sort themselves out because those are just sort of baked into the system.
And that the surprises will come from the fact, correct me if I'm wrong, that a lot of people who are signing up for this have never had insurance, or it's been a long time since they've had insurance before. Because I've changed insurance companies over the years with jobs and so forth, and things change.
Things do change. I think that the message here, though, was that if you President Obama said you can get health care coverage for the cost of a monthly cell phone bill, right? But that's only to get the coverage.
Mm-hmm.
And some of these plans have pretty extensive deductibles and copayments built in. And so somebody who's thinking that, wow, I've stretched my budget, I've come up with enough to make that monthly premium, who doesn't have the experience with the insurance system, could still be in for some surprises, even if they've received a subsidy for their premium, even if they've decided that they are going to get covered, which the law requires. There could be surprises there.
A lot of people need to take prescriptions every day. Are we seeing gaps in prescription drug coverage? Has that been working out okay?
That's a great question. I mean, back in 2006, when Medicare's prescription drug program, known as Part D, took effect, there were widely publicized stories of people going to the pharmacies to fill their prescriptions and being turned away without getting their prescription. So that was actually a huge concern, and Medicare did a whole lot at that time to ensure that that was corrected quickly. I think people were very nervous that would happen now with the trouble that they had setting this up. So you have major pharmacy chains like Walgreens and CVS and Walmart all saying that they're going to help people get through this first month, even if their insurance isn't yet set up right, and get so that they're not getting their medications. That's a good thing, and I think that's going to make that's made this transition period a lot quieter than I would have expected, right? So what I expected was come the first of the year, these delays in enrollment and other things would pop themselves up, and you would hear widespread stories that people were being turned away when they sought care. I'm not hearing that in the volume that I had. You're hearing some sporadic stories, but it's just not an overwhelming blitz of them at this point.
The next step is finding a doctor. Is that just a matter of looking up which doctors are in your network? Are the insurance companies doing a good job of getting those networks out to people so they know what they're talking about?
This has improved with time. If you go to healthcare.gov, you now don't have to log in and create an account in order to do window shopping. You're able to examine plans, to type in your circumstances, to look at differences within those plans, to see their provider networks, to see the drugs that they cover, all without signing in. So this is all on healthcare.gov. And the challenge is Getting folks to look beyond that sticker price, the premium, the monthly premium, and to understand that there's a lot of components that go into picking an insurance plan. And you and I know, because we deal with this, you know, sort of in getting a private insurance plan from our employer, we do this regularly, but that you want to look at monthly costs. You want to look at how much does it cost to visit the doctor. You want to look at, are your doctors and hospitals in this network? You want to look at, is the drug I take covered by this insurance plan? So you have to look at all of those things when choosing an insurance plan.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. My guest is Charlie Ornstein. He is the senior reporter for ProPublica. We're talking about the Affordable Care Act, the rollout. It is now law of the land. If you have a question or comment, give us a call, 614-292-8513, or you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. So are a lot of folks finding that they do need to pick new doctors because their plans have been canceled? There was a lot of recent unhappiness about that.
So it's not – so, yes, there are going to be people whose insurance plans had previously been canceled who have to pick a new plan and may have to find a new doctor. But it's more than just the people whose insurance plans have been canceled, because I think one of the tools that insurance companies have used in order to the extent possible, lower their premiums in these health marketplaces is to come up with what's called narrow networks. What a narrow network means is that you selectively choose the doctors and hospitals that you will offer the consumers in order to choose folks who are either cost-effective in their care or who deliver a higher quality or lower cost care. And so you're able to offer a lower cost, but you're able to reduce the choices for people. People may be surprised to learn that, you know, popular hospitals or doctors that they really like are not in the plan that they chose.
We have an email from a listener. They ask, are vaccinations like the shingles vaccine covered with no copay and deductible under the Affordable Care Act? And I suppose the larger question is, are there other things like that, too, if so?
So the Affordable Care Act, one of the components of it is that it provides free preventive services to patients. And so I'm not sure about that particular vaccine. I believe it is. But, for example, you can now get certain screening tests if you qualify without a copay. You can get contraception without a copay. So these are things that the Affordable Care Act put into place and will now affect, you know, plans throughout the system. And that's one of the changes that the law built in.
And the insurance companies have to follow these rules. So you ought to know what the law says to make sure your insurance company is following the rules, right?
I think for the most part, insurance companies understand what they have to cover and what they don't have to cover.
Okay.
It gets tricky, though, right? So if you have a colonoscopy, which is a preventive service, and you don't pay a copay for it, but it identifies polyps that have to be removed, you will indeed have to pay a copay to have that performed. So if the preventive screening identifies a problem or a mammogram, that does not mean that the whole coverage of what's identified is provided free to you.
You made the point earlier that some of the big issues have been the issue of transmitting between the companies and government. There have been some major problems with people newly deemed eligible for Medicaid, which a lot more have because of Medicaid expansion. It seems that healthcare.gov is having big trouble transferring income and personal information to state Medicaid agencies, including Ohio, because we don't have our own state-run healthcare exchange.
Right. So this is actually a concern and one that I think we're going to be hearing more about. When a consumer goes to healthcare.gov and enters in their information, healthcare.gov may determine that they would qualify for Medicaid. And what it intends to do is transmit that information to state Medicaid programs in order for the person to be enrolled in the state Medicaid program, including, say, in Ohio's. There's been major problems, though, in transmitting that information, and it's just not been working the way it's supposed to. So what you're finding is that people who thought that they were going to be enrolled in Medicaid programs beginning January 1st, that's just not happened. And people are aware of it. I think that there's a really big effort to try to get that fixed, because these are people who are poor and who don't have other choices and don't have the funds to purchase insurance on the exchanges, and this is their source of health coverage. I think this is one of those temporary issues. They have to fix it, and they will fix it, but it's if you're one of those people who's caught in the middle, it is a mighty uncomfortable situation.
Now, Ohio, I shouldn't say the word finally, but the governor pushed through a Medicaid expansion in Ohio this fall. which fell far behind the deadline that was set back when the law passed. So this, it's still confusing. Does that mean that people in Ohio automatically will get Medicaid this year with the rollout, or are they going to have to wait another year?
So the issues that I'm talking about with respect to transmitting information, that affects people who are eligible under a Medicaid expansion as well as those who are just eligible under the old rules and who were just now applying for coverage under healthcare.gov. I'm not familiar with the particular rules of when the expansion in Ohio takes effect for citizens of Ohio. So if you didn't previously qualify for Medicaid under the previous rules, but you would under the expansion, when you would first be eligible for coverage. It may well be that that began on January 1st. I don't have the answer to that.
Okay. Well, you mentioned that there's a surprise in the lack of, there's not a lot of people rushing for medical care, but there also aren't, we're also far from having the total number of people sign up for the Affordable Care Act. Or
there's no question that the Congressional Budget Office estimated that 7 million people would sign up for coverage under the Affordable Care Act in 2014. We're a long way away from that. I think you saw a very impressive sign-ups toward the first deadline of December 23rd, which then was extended until December 24th. But I do think that you're going to see over the course of the next 2 months before the March 31st, final deadline, the expectation is that you'll see a whole lot more people sign up, particularly the younger folks. If you are young and you don't have major health concerns, there's less of a reason that you would have to run to get coverage beginning January 1st. The people I've talked to have said that those are high-touch consumers, meaning you have to sort of continue to reinforce for them that this is the law, that they have to do it even if they don't think they need it, and that those are the folks that you would hope and expect would come in later in the process and before the deadline to have coverage in order to avoid a tax penalty, which is to sign up by March 31st.
It makes sense that the people who signed up right away are the more sicker, the older, the more people who are have more health problems.
You expect there's going to be two groups of folks who are going to sign up right away. The first are the people whose insurance plans were canceled. They had insurance. They want insurance. If their plans are canceled, they need to sign up in order to continue to be insured. So that's one group. The second is folks who were denied health insurance previously because of pre-existing conditions. And for that group of people, they've been waiting for the day when they can get health insurance. They want it. And now it's affordable and it's accessible and there aren't rules that can deny them coverage. And so those are folks who you would expect. And then finally, individuals who may be older but not necessarily sick and who see this as a good opportunity because of the subsidies that are available to sign up. So the incentive is there at the initially for people who really need it to take it to take effect. I think for other folks, it's going to take a little more education to get them to that point.
Now, wasn't it that children with pre-existing conditions, they've been able to sign up or been able to, insurance companies have been required to provide insurance to them for a couple years now, right?
For the kids, right. Yeah. But I'm talking about the adults, right? So good point is that for the adults who haven't been able to get coverage because of pre-existing conditions, that restriction was lifted effective January 1st.
Are we seeing continuing improvements on the website?
Absolutely. I mean, it was a disaster. There's no way to sugarcoat that. Anybody who tries to say that this was part of the plan or that this was excusable, I think that's just not the case. The first 2 months of this could not have gone worse for the administration. It was incredibly difficult to sign up. You saw that in the enrollment numbers. You've seen that in documents that have come out from congressional committees. And even the president has owned up to that. Mm-hmm. But I think something major happened on January 1st, which is that we're no longer talking about a law that was sort of getting ready to take effect. It actually took effect. And so people are now experiencing this. So we're not fighting over something that's the future. The future is actually today.
And do we expect more fighting in Congress over this? I mean, some people are like, I don't know what to do. They could change this. There's a lot of insecurity out there.
No question. I mean, there's no question that you're going to see fighting in Congress. I think you're going to continue to see efforts to repeal it. You're going to see efforts to make changes to it. I think that to expose problems in its implementation. There's several congressional committees and Senate committees that are looking into the implementation. That's going to continue to be an issue. The oversight and of this will, you will hear about that for months and years to come.
Okay, well, Charlie Ornstein, hopefully we'll be hearing from you for months then as well, because we need help.
Yeah, for sure.
Okay, Charlie Ornstein's a senior reporter for ProPublica. Once again, if you were listening earlier to our discussion about mental health care for adolescents, teenagers, we have some links for you on our website at WOSU.org, hopefully by later today, to give you more resources to work with. Thanks for listening to Wellness Wednesday today on All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.